Hello, and welcome to This Week in History Class. I'm your host, John Larson. This week we're going to be talking about the 1960s, and there's a lot of really neat things that students have put out. As always with the 60s, we're going to talk about music. We're also going to talk about a little culture today, which is kind of fun. A few different things going on there. And then some news events that are coming out of the 1960s that maybe you didn't know about. Some maybe you did, but some maybe you didn't. So we're going to get started right off the bat with music, and we're going to talk a little bit about the Beatles with Maddie, Kendra, and Zoe.
Today we are here to inform you a little more about the Beatles and how they got started. Paul McCartney was born June 18, 1942, in Liverpool, England. When McCartney was just 14 years old, his mother died. John Lennon also lost his mother at a young age. This was a bond that the two of them shared. McCartney's father encouraged him to try many different musical instruments. He took many formal music lessons as a boy. He learned how to play the Spanish guitar, trumpet, and piano. In 1957, McCartney met Lennon at a church music festival, and they quickly became friends and later became the songwriters for the Beatles.
I will be talking about John Lennon in the early years when he was in the band and some other important facts about him. He was born on October 9, 1940. He was a singer and songwriter, which later on became worldwide fame. He was a founder and member of the Beatles. His first band was called Quarrymen, which later on evolved into the Beatles in 1960. John Lennon died on December 8, 1980. He died from being assassinated by Mark David Chapman.
Ringo Starr was born as Richard Starkey on July 7, 1940 in Liverpool, England. He was a drummer for the Beatles. He also wrote songs for the group like With a Little Help from My Friends and Octopus's Garden. He joined the band Rory Storm and the Hurricanes in the late 1950s. They gave him the nickname Ringo by all the rings he wore. He was playing in Hamburg, Germany at the time when the Beatles asked him to join them in the 1960s. The Beatles went from 3 to 4 that year and from then became legends.
George Harrison was born on February 25, 1943. He was the lead guitarist and sometimes sang for the Beatles. When Harrison was younger, he went to Liverpool Institute and an acclaimed grammar school where he attended and where he also first met Paul McCartney. Harrison was not much of a student and was not interested in school when he discovered the electric guitar and American rock and roll. When George was 14, he purchased his first guitar and also taught himself a few chords. In early 1958, McCartney had been pushing the 17-year-old Lennon to let the 14-year-old Harrison join their first band. George Harrison passed away on November 29th in 2001 of cancer.
Thanks, ladies. Next up, we have the Rolling Stones with Zach and Jacob.
People assume that time is a strict progression of cause to effect, but from a non-linear, non-subjective point of view, it's more like a big ball of wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey stuff.
Speaking of wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey stuff, the 1960s.
The Rolling Stones were an English rock band that was formed in the 1962. The original members of the band were Mick Jagger, Brian Jones, Ian Stewart, Keith Richards, Bill Wyman, and Charlie Watts. The band is still playing to this very day.
Some of their hit songs were Paint It Black, Satisfaction, Sympathy for the Devil, and some other ones that nobody really cares about. The Rolling Stones had their first U.S. tour in 1964. It was a disaster, as Bill Wyman put it.
They were not very well known in the U.S. They played on the show The Hollywood Palace. That week's guest star host was Dean Martin, and he made fun of their performance and their hair. From 1965 to 1967, the Stones were just starting to get popular.
This time period was called the height of fame for the Stones. In 1967, Jagger, Richards, and Jones began to be hounded for recreational drug use. Many cases were opened, but none of them turned out to be true. A week after being accused of use again, the police raided a party at Keith Richards' home.
No arrests were made, but Jagger, Richards, and one of their friends were charged with drug offenses.
What do you even do? You're just a plant.
Richards later said, "After that, we took our position seriously. Up until then, we saw England as a place where you could do anything that you wanted. 1968 to 1972 was known as the Golden Age for the Stones.
Most of this time was spent making the album Beggar's Banquet. Everyone knows the Stones' signature logo, but most of you probably don't know that the bright red tongue was not introduced until 1971. The Rolling Stones did most of their recording in the U.S., as they were now more well-known for their music in the U.K.
The Beatles seem to have claimed the U.S., and while people from the U.S. still love the Stones, the charts showed that they were more popular in the U.K.
Rock and roll would not be where it's at today if we didn't have the Stones. Thanks for listening to This Week in History Class.
Oh, and one last thing. Bow ties are cool.
Thanks, guys. And thank you so much for the Doctor Who references. They made my day. Next up, we have some more music. And this comes from Tori. And he's going to tell us a little bit about Led Zeppelin.
Led Zeppelin was one of the biggest bands in the world in their heyday of the early to mid-1970s, and are still a major influence on modern rock, with instantly recognizable songs like Stairway to Heaven and Kashmir. But before they were a massive commercial and critical success, they were filling in for the end of another early rock group called the Yardbirds, whose early members included Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, and Jimmy Page. Page was given permission to use the name to finish the band's final tour with the members of his choice. His picks ended up being vocalist Robert Plant and drummer John Bonham of Band of Joy, and John Paul Jones, a studio guitarist. In 1968, they played their first live gig together as the New Yardbirds. After the end of the scheduled tour, the original members of the band made the new members change their name. So, the members took inspiration from a joke made by Keith Moon and John Entwistle, after suggesting a supergroup containing the two, Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck, would go down like a lead balloon. The band members dropped the A in lead and replaced balloon with Zeppelin, and they had a name that would hold them over for many years to come. They released their first album as a group, the self-titled Led Zeppelin, in January of 1969, including Good Times, Bad Times, which reached number 6 on the UK charts and number 10 on the American charts. Their first album was not well received by the critics, but that didn't stop them from embarking on 4 US tours and 4 UK tours and releasing their second album, appropriately titled Led Zeppelin II, in October of 1969. Including the iconic tracks Whole Lotta Love and Ramble On, this album took the number 1 spots on both the US and UK charts, knocking off the Beatles' Abbey Road on the US charts. With this, the band ended their first year of existence well on their way to becoming rock legends. By the time they disbanded in 1980, shortly after Bonham's death, they released a total of 9 albums, with a 10th consisting of unused cuts released in 1982. They had certified sales of 111.5 million units, with some estimates as high as 200 to 300 million. The band has put on 3 reunion shows and has released reissues of their albums periodically since the breakup. Love them or hate them, there is no denying that Led Zeppelin has had a major influence on not just rock, but music in general.
Thanks, guys. Hold on.
Okay, that's better. Sorry. Don't know what happened there. Must have tweaked something. Anyway, I should be back to normal now. We should be good to go. Anyway, all right. We're going to stay in the 60s, but we're going to switch gears from music to the overall culture. Next up, we've got Josh and Mitch telling us about some of the sports, athletics that are going on in the 1960s.
Hi there. It's Mitch Vernick and Josh Prawl here, and we're going to talk a little bit about football and baseball in the 60s. Every team in the NFL has one ultimate goal, and that is making it to the Super Bowl and winning the Vince Lombardi Trophy. Trophy signifies the very best team in the NFL. It is awarded to the Super Bowl champion every year. The first Super Bowl took place on January 15th, 1967, when the Green Bay Packers of the NFL coached by Vince Lombardi, took on the Kansas City Chiefs of the AFL. The Packers won 35-10 in that first Super Bowl, then won the next year as well, beating the Oakland Raiders 33-14 in Super Bowl II. Lombardi retired as head coach of the Packers shortly after the second Super Bowl game. Initially, the Super Bowl trophy was just called the World Professional Championship Football Trophy. It remained that way until 1970, when it was renamed the Vince Lombardi Trophy, in honor of the coach who died suddenly from cancer in, of 1970.
Now I'm going to talk a little bit about baseball. Baseball was dominated by the Yankees in the first few seasons of the 60s. But after 1965, they were not the team to beat anyone. In the late 60s, pitching ruled the game, as guys like Bob Gibson and Sandy Koufax dominated the game so much they had to change the rules. The Twins in the 60s had a very good offensive team. They dominated the league scoring with 774 runs. Detroit finished a distant second with 680 runs. The Twins had two of the top hitters in the league, Harmon Killebrew and Tony Oliva. Shortstop Zoilo Rosales led the league in total bases and runs scored. He won a gold glove and was named the league's most valuable player.
Thanks, guys. Now we're going to, again, switch gears. Stay in culture, but we're going to look at a different side of culture in the 1960s, and we're going to look at fashion in the 1960s. And to do that, we've got Kari and Nisa.
Fashion of the 1960s.
This is important because this is the fashion that led into the crazy 1970s.
So let's break it down.
Audrey Hepburn and a British model named Twiggy were style icons to the nation, and everyone followed Coco Chanel's fashion advice.
Baroque prints, khaki material, and light colors, light beiges and pastels were normal at the beginning of the 60s, but by the end the clothing took a 180 degree turn.
Dressing like a flapper was way out of style. There became a bohemian twist in 1969, which then was over-exaggerated into a hippie style of clothing.
Bell bottoms and orange weren't yet in style, so in the 60s there was a real testing the boundaries phase. It became one of the last years of women always wearing dresses.
Women used to get dressed up for everything, and now it became less important. Women were getting more of the rights men had, and slowly but surely became more of dressing in pants, blazers, and some runways, even ties.
The clothing was less modest, and by the end of the era, the sophistication had been lost, and cropped and tight tops were vogue.
Early in the era, the clothing of the 1960s are matching the present style of now. Elegance is once again present, as we do wear pearls, big jackets, and classy shoes. Coco Chanel is dead, but the head of her company, Karl Lagerfeld, has told us that Baroque prints are in with his 2014 spring collection.
Pastels are in and now in our world from the 60s, but the phrase, what comes around goes around, is ever present. In our future society, we will be seeing a more classy and chic version of the early 70s clothing in summer 2015 to 2016. If you pay close attention to the runways.
Bye!
Thanks, Kari and Nisa. Anyone who knows me knows I definitely will be paying close attention to the runways. And now, we're going to be looking at one last bit of culture, not really from the 60s, but about the 60s. And this is a review of the theatrical performance of Hairspray.
Hairspray is about life in Baltimore in the 1960s. Tracy Turnblad is a teenager whose biggest dream is to be on the Corny Collins show. But to be on the show, you must look a certain way, meaning you can't be overweight and you can't be black. You couldn't be black in a main character because people were very much against them being integrated.
One of the Corny Collins show cast members ends up leaving the show, so they hold auditions. Tracy then gets on the show, which doesn't make everyone happy. Tracy then sees Negro Day, in which the black people can be on the show, but are not allowed to dance with the white cast, and it must be separated. Tracy doesn't like that.
Her goal is to make the show integrated. Tracy, along with her friend Penny, her family, and everyone else she meets along the way, are sure to make it happen in this dance-filled and 1960s musical adventure. This musical makes people realize how much blacks and whites were segregated even in movies and films. Even though movies were extremely popular in the 60s, blacks were still not allowed to audition. This film shows that even though blacks are still not accepted in society, not all white people are for segregation, such as the main character, Tracy.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, and I hope you learned why Hairspray can tie into the conflicts of the 1960s. If you get the chance to ever watch Hairspray, you should, because it's an awesome movie.
That review is from Asia, Hannah, and Kayla. And thanks, ladies. That was a great job. Now we're going to take a little bit of a turn in the last two segments of the show today. And they are going to be for things that are not exactly fun, not exactly enjoyable, but things that definitely were going on in the 60s. The first is going to come from Paige, and it's going to be about thalidomide. Something that actually very few people know about, which is I'm very happy she chose this topic. And finally, Bryn and Carly are going to talk to us about the assassinations in the 1960s, and there were a number of them.
Hello. For my podcast, I am going to talk about thalidomide. Thalidomide was a medication intended for pregnant women to combat morning sickness and is an aid to help them sleep. Unfortunately, inadequate tests were performed to assess the drug's safety. Between 1957 and 1962, children of women who took the drug thalidomide during pregnancy were born with severe deformities, including only stubs for arms. Some were even born with no legs, no arms, or some even had flippers or digits emerging from their shoulders. Because of the tragedy, the drug was taken off the market in 1962. Of the 10,000 children born with birth defects, only 5,000 lived beyond their childhood. After years of research on the uses of thalidomide, it was allowed to be used to prevent nausea in chemotherapy patients, as well as treating painful skin conditions. In 2006, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration actually granted approval for thalidomide to be used in special cases. Thank you for listening to my podcast.
This is Bryn and Carly, and we are doing our podcast this week on the assassinations of the 1960s.
The 1960s were a hard time for Americans due to how many major assassinations took place that shook the country. Starting with John F. Kennedy's death on November 22, 1963 in Dallas, Texas. Kennedy was born on May 29, 1917. He lived for 46 years. As soon as people heard of the assassination, about 54% of the country took off work to mourn the death, and schools closed for kids to go home to their families.
The next assassination was that of Malcolm X on February 21, 1965. He lived for 39 years, killed while giving a speech in New York City by a group of Nation of Islam members. The third assassination was the not well-liked American Nazi leader George Lincoln Rockwell on the date of August 25, 1967. Martin Luther King Jr. was the fourth assassination of the 1960s. He was killed by James Earl Ray on April 4, 1968. He was shot while standing on a balcony outside his hotel in Memphis, Tennessee. Lyndon B. Johnson called for a day of mourning on April 7th.
The politician Robert F. Kennedy was the fifth and final assassination of the 60s, assassinated by Sirhan Sirhan on June 5, 1968. He said he had nothing against Kennedy, but there was evidence proving what he said was wrong.
Thanks, ladies, and everyone else that helped out with the podcast this week. This is the last podcast of the third quarter, but there are more coming up. Starting next quarter, we'll have continue, actually, with the 1960s, but we will have many, many more coming up all the way through the end of the year, and discussing multiple topics throughout the rest of the 20th century into the 21st century. So I'm excited for it. I hope others are too. This has been This Week in History Class. If you want to follow us on Twitter, we don't tweet a whole bunch, but every once in a while we throw up some stuff. It's at TWIHC, or you can follow me at Twitter at TeacherJLars, and I'm on Instagram also at TeacherJLars. Thanks again to everyone who presented this week, as well as Ethan Frazier for our theme music. Again, this has been This Week in History Class. I'm John Larson. Thanks for listening. Bye now.